currently quite in vogue in HE, but I'm also coming at things from a slightly different angle institutionally, in as much as I work in a post 92 very teaching intensive university. So I think it brings a slightly different perspective. Firstly, I want to emphasise that aspects of this work directly addressing notions of resilience are drawn from an ongoing collaborative project with Dr. Dave Webster. So he was working within the same school as me, but has recently taken up a position as the director of the Centre for Teaching and Learning at SOAS, so he can't be here today. But nonetheless, I need to acknowledge his role and input in shaping these discussions, not least, I think, because as frequently happens when he's invited to present alone, people pretend that I don't even exist. So, and I kind of kick up about that, so I thought it was important to acknowledge that he does exist and has added to this slightly. Secondly, then, I want to contextualise this research a little in order to give some understanding as to how it came about and what really sparked my interest in these discourses of resilience. I'm currently employed on a 0.2 fraction, which means I'm paid for one day a week, at a post-92 teaching intensive university, and I have been for the last 4 years. So as a 0.2, I have a considerable teaching load. I currently teach a double first-year undergraduate module, supervise 7 dissertation students, and I have one MRes student, so one Masters by Research student. I have frequently, however, had a 2-2 teaching load, so 2 modules per semester, 7 dissertation students, master's students or PhD students. And this is all apparently possible to happen in one day a week. So obviously, as we all know, workload allocation models really do fail to represent what we do and the realities of our work in numerous ways. Particularly, I think, from where I'm at, for example, marking assignments. So we're allocated 30 minutes per student per module. That's irrespective of how many assignments a student will submit for that module. So you're often using 30 minutes to mark maybe 3,000 word assignments. So on top of the kind of workload that they put into your model, the teaching hours, you have the marking and you have the preparation. And I think everybody is kind of dealing with similar things there. I don't want to put on your microphone. But on top of this, then there's the kind of there's no allocation for the numerous emails sent by anxious students in the middle of the night whenever there's an assignment due, which have to be responded to within a 48-hour window, or in terms of emotional labour, the hours spent on the pastoral care that goes into helping young people who are often away from home for the first time ever to really kind of surviving and thriving on a degree course. There's similarly no reflection for the kind of anxiety and stress that this kind of job puts onto staff, which I think is where resilience has entered the mix. So despite the obvious exploitation I face as a fractional early career academic, I am still consistently told by well-meaning, more senior colleagues, just to keep going, to not give up, that you've published a book, you've published articles, you're getting there. I'm clearly not getting there. But in short, just to keep being more resilient. And whilst this is intended as encouragement, and I think is seemingly benign, it also serves to reframe my experiences, or at least the apparent solution to them, as deeply individual. So yet a quick glance at Twitter will show you just how widespread these issues are. Amongst all academic staff, not just precariously employed early career academics, but particularly amongst fractional and part-time hourly paid people. So these are clearly not individually experienced issues. And this, coupled with the barrage of emails that I've been getting from my university health and wellbeing team, offering resilience training and the chance to make stress my friend, is what sparked this kind of initial research project into notions of resilience, particularly within a neoliberal academy. So in academia, then, the apparent need to increase individual resilience works to normalise what I would consider to be a relatively toxic working environment for staff. I don't know if you've heard of the online group Shit Academics Say, people are on Twitter, but you know, they demonstrate regularly through numerous widely shared tweets that anxiety and imposter syndrome are now so normal that they've become a bit of an insider joke, that these are things that we kind of laugh off. And I think there's a gallows humour to headlines such as Why You'll Never Make It in Academia, which they featured on the front of a spoof magazine called Anxiety. which is unfortunately too close to home for some of us to be funny. But however dark your humour, I think what's really not funny is a recently shared study where it was shared over 62,000 times, so it clearly resonated with people, that suggested approximately one third of PhD students suffer with depression. So they cited high job demands and low job control as key contributing factors. So essentially, there was an acknowledgement that the system is the problem. Yet, when resilience training is offered to temper the stresses of working within this environment, the narrative works to instead insist that the problem is you. And as the memes state, it's either a poor work ethic or sheer incompetency holding you back. So resilience then is touted as an essential ingredient of success, implying that structural inequalities and issues can be overcome by the sheer force of willpower and a kind of can-do attitude. So Sarah Ahmed has written about resilience, and she says, we can see how resilience is a technology of will, or even functions as a command. You'd be willing to bear more, be stronger so you can bear more. We can understand, too, how resilience becomes a deeply conservative technique, one especially well-suited to governance. So you encourage bodies to strengthen so that they will not succumb to pressure, so that they can keep taking it, and so that they can take more of it. So resilience is the requirement to take more pressure, such that pressure can gradually be increased. To make stress your friend, then, has nothing to do with improving your working conditions or indeed your home life, but everything to do with maintaining this kind of toxic status quo. But crucially within discourses of resilience, there's also no acknowledgement of the fact that some people within academia are already required to be far more resilient than others, and in life in general. So to borrow from Ahmed's framing, some people are already asked to bear more. And with regard to academia, the turn towards resilience offers no acknowledgement of the various external factors that might influence your chances of securing that ever elusive permanent contract. So from distinctions based on race, class, gender and ableism, or any mixture of these intersecting factors, to the prevalence of elitism and prestige, and how that can add to people's navigational capital and aid them in kind of steering their way through HE. Discourses of resilience also really assume a level playing field. They promote notions of meritocracy. They don't question the numerous factors that influence life chances and outcomes outside of an individual's control. So although my focus has predominantly in my research been on early career academics, the push to be hyperproductive or indeed resilient is felt across higher education. And Ros Gill has argued that the kitchen of academia is, it would seem, too hot for almost everyone. But this has not resulted in a collective action to turn down the heat, but instead to an overheated competitive atmosphere in which acts of kindness, generosity and solidarity often seem to continue in spite of and rather than because of the governance of universities. So the proliferation of the discourses of resilience disrupt possibilities for collective action that might help turn down this hyper-competitive atmosphere in higher education by presenting only deeply individualized responses. And so thus they kind of further the neoliberal grip on both academics and on their students. You know, often it's the students that bear the brunt of the overstressed and overworked academic. And it swaps the opportunity to, at the very least, critique and acknowledge these numerous structural issues impacting on people's chances of success, to instead presenting a blind faith in notions of agency and the power of the individual. Problematically, though, I think many of the solutions presented as a means to resist this kind of uberfication of the university also operate a kind of politics of privilege. So this goes to kind of one of the questions that was asked in the other panel about precarity. Resisting administrative roles, for example, spending less time providing feedback for students, or for some people I've heard just avoiding teaching altogether, are kind of often touted as ways of reducing the pressure on ourselves. Yet these kind of strategies are rarely, if at all, possible for those at the beginning of their career, especially not for those on fractional or fixed-term contracts, where there's a feeling, whether real or perceived, that you really are only ever one kind of dodgy module evaluation away from being kicked out the door. Which brings me to, if you need to be resilient to survive in academia at all, then I think engaging with feminist pedagogy can magnify these demands. And this is bringing me to some of the kind of specific challenges of teaching feminism in a post-92 institution. especially one with an overwhelmingly white conservative student population. So one of the first things I want to note is at the institution I teach in, across our entire humanities provision, there are no modules that mention feminism in their titles. So I never ever get to walk into a class with people even vaguely wanting to engage with feminism. And there are only a handful that reference gender kind of elusively. It's also important to note that there are no people of colour teaching within the humanities department that I work in, none at all. So students are not attending these classes with any intention of engaging with feminism, and far from having kind of experiencing calls to decolonise the curriculum, I've received student evaluations calling for me to be sacked for my apparently obvious bias against white men that's been gauged from my reading list. And these are all anonymous. I mean, also, when did we sign up for anonymous evaluations? It's just the worst. So you get these kind of anonymous things saying, well, she's brainwashing her students, and you can tell this by her reading list. And then you're brought in by your head of department saying, well, we've only got 16 students, so you can't piss off four of them. So put Sartre on there, or someone dead and white, you know. So these are the kind of negotiations that's being made. And I think this speaks to what Aween was saying in that I'm deeply critical of decolonising being commercialised and taken as a model that can be sold, but thank goodness at least some places are doing something. You know, I work in an institution where you don't mention that, it's just not on. So as a fractional member of staff, that kind of feedback obviously heightens a sense of vulnerability and, in a very real sense, my precarity. And this, I think, is particularly amplified at a time when the notion of students as consumers and audit-driven culture by the NSS and by the TEF make student feedback key to measuring any idea of academic value or worth. There are also, I think, risks involved in being openly feminist at a time when academia is caricatured and pilloried in the press for being a hotbed of so-called cultural Marxism or lefty liberalism. You know, I'm kind of a walking stereotype. Especially when you work within a relatively conservative institution that neither supports nor values explicit political engagement. And I think this is exacerbated by the fact that still within certain humanities departments, there's a sense that feminism and feminist pedagogy are somehow soft subjects or approaches to teaching that take an overly emotional view and are apparently lacking then in academic rigour. So in 1991, Amanda Coffrey and Sandra Acker argued following interviews with various self-identified feminist teachers that they kind of revealed their frustration and anger at being referred to as left or as women's libbers. But it wasn't necessarily the stereotyping to which they objected, but rather the result that any of the initiatives they put forward and their arguments were often not taken seriously because of this label. So the lack of seriousness afforded to feminist scholarship, of course, further exacerbates experiences of imposter syndrome and feelings of not belonging, which are also unequally distributed through HE. So some people are obviously made to feel more like they belong than others. So as I've suggested then, engaging with feminist pedagogy in the neoliberal academy intersects with resilience and vulnerability in numerous ways. It leaves you exposed to negative feedback, which is then validated by a climate of anti-intellectualism, or at least certainly anti-left-wing intellectualism in the media, and at a time when student feedback is seen as a key indicator of academic worth. This in turn heightens feelings of vulnerability and precarity, which again are an affective experience already unevenly distributed through HE, and more commonly felt by those that are already marginalised within academia, which then leads to the apparent need to develop this individual resilience as a way to stay and a way to survive. Thinking more positively about vulnerability, Judith Butler has recently written of the potential that reconceptualising vulnerability may have in offering a path to resistance rather than resilience. Of course, Butler does note that issues that can arise from associating feminist activism with vulnerability, not least, I think, because of the concerns that she cites that if feminism in any way becomes associated with vulnerability, it will become captured by the term and women will end up being portrayed in ways that rob them of their agency. So there's a very real concern about that. However, Butler argues against this, and she suggests that vulnerability allows us to understand ourselves as simultaneously acting and being acted upon. That to an awareness of our own vulnerability is an awareness of ourselves in relation to others and our environment. And so this then goes some way towards undoing neoliberal understandings of this kind of atomized, deeply isolated individual. As such, then, making vulnerability integral to resistance as both a cause and effect seems to necessitate a more collective response or reaction to conditions of precarity, rather than the kind of individualized approach based on fostering personal resilience. I think, without wanting to disagree with Judith Butler, as with resilience, though, it's really important to acknowledge the unequal way that vulnerability operates. And the differing costs that people are asked to pay in laying their vulnerability open to others. So who gets to be openly vulnerable and how vulnerability is received is neither random nor equal, and vulnerability is not always mobilised fairly. So, for example, Ruby Hamad wrote in The Guardian recently that displays of vulnerability from white women, and specifically white women's tears, can be part of a toxic femininity, which is used to shut down and distract from resistance of white privilege and racism. So Hamad also points out that vulnerability, as a way of kind of mobilising action, actually isn't often open to black women. I said 17, I'm so sorry. So she writes, speaking of black women and herself, she writes, whether angry or calm, shouting or pleading, we are still perceived as the aggressors. Likewise, white women are equally aware that their race privileges them as surely as ours condemns us. In this context, their tearful displays are a form of emotional and psychological violence that reinforce the very system of white dominance that many white women claim to oppose. So in this way, vulnerability can be used to shut down rather than spark a resistance. In terms of work, similarly, the increasingly popular phenomenon of CVs of failure, I don't know if people have heard of those, so where academics in relatively secure positions document the jobs that they weren't shortlisted for or the grants that they didn't get, I think also represent a problematic engagement with vulnerability. Although there's undoubtedly something to be said for CVs of failure fostering solidarity across career stages, they risk validating or normalising what for many is an unbearable struggle. And they also mobilise vulnerability from a distinctly invulnerable position. CVs of failure are popular precisely because the people who get to publish them have succeeded. That's why we like them. So they motivate people to keep going, thus subtly furthering these discourses of resilience and suggesting that you only ever really fail if you stop. So although vulnerability offers opportunities to understand ourselves and our struggles in relation to each other, and the environment then, I think perhaps we need to move more towards the kind of generosity that's been espoused by people like Les Beck and Rosalind Gill, where we acknowledge a web of obligation and interdependency that holds academia together, so that we look out for each other and we resist these deeply individualising narratives of HE that foster a permanent state of competition and anxiety. But this is a kind of strategic generosity, which is interesting, but really does have to cut across career positions. It really does have to cut across ideas of privilege and prestige, so that it isn't always the same groups of people. And in my experience from doing a lot of talks on resilience recently, it's always precariously employed, often young, often women, who are always raising their voices in dissent against the working conditions within this neoliberal academy. Although generosity towards ourselves and others, I think, is crucial in terms of surviving within the neoliberal academy, I also want to ask, what do we do if we want to do more than simply survive? So engaging with feminist pedagogy seems, at least to me, to be about more than surviving and to be about shifting the status quo. It's a form, I think, of radical optimism, rooted in rebellion. So as bell hooks has said in Teaching to Transgress, feminist classrooms are a space where it's assumed that the knowledge offered to students would empower them beyond the classroom to live more fully in the world, and that the feminist classroom was one space where students really could raise kind of critical questions and challenge the status quo. Yet, I guess, increasingly, feminist pedagogy feels like it risks being dismissed as hopeless and utopian, especially at a time when scepticism and cynicism appear to be the fastest routes towards anyone taking you seriously intellectually. However, I would argue to kick back against cynicism and scepticism then can make engaging with feminist pedagogy a practice of hope, And accepting the narrative of needing to toughen up, of needing to increase your individual resilience, is the antithesis of hope. It's acknowledging that nothing can change apart from one's own individual reaction to uncomfortable situations. So although, to finish, I would say that you undoubtedly do need a fair amount of resilience to survive in HE, turning to resilience training seems to me to be akin with giving up. So whether the route to resistance is through vulnerability or even through generosity, what's needed is more of a rebellion than resilience. Done.
Thank you so much, Nikki. And I'm sure you're left with lots of things you want to ask and discuss, but we'll do that after we've heard from Janine. Do you want to join us? I'll get your slides on.